You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic.
I'm Matt Garasimovich, PhD candidate at Northwestern University, studying Russian literature and film.
And I'm Cameron Lalana, a literature enthusiast and a guy working in media. We're two friends who met studying in Russia. We like talking about books so much that we made it into a podcast.
And speaking of our podcast, this is the podcast for people who want to learn more about Slavic literature, art, and culture. Every episode, we're going to be bringing you the background and analysis you'll need to know and understand these works.
If you're interested in supporting us, you can head on over to our website, slaviclitpod.com. All right, Matt, we're getting back into life and fate as we do every day. But what portion specifically are we covering? What should the good people have read to enter this episode? And I do hope you've read it.
Yeah, if not, Cameron's going to come hunt you down. So you should have read from book 1, chapter 61, to book 2, chapter 20. That is going to be the crux of the discussion for our episode today.
Yeah, and luckily there's a lot of bouncing back and forth. So if you were thinking it's a little bit too easy, the narrative is a little bit too straightforward, don't worry, we got you covered.
Yeah, if you were thinking you finally started to get the hang of it, well, no worries.
No worries. Grossman has just started writing like a fan fiction author, desperate to keep everyone's attention as they bounce around from character to character. So there's a lot of cliffhangers.
True. And if you are feeling unsure about any of the particular chapters, especially any of the ones that we're not going to have time to cover in this episode, we are talking about every single chapter, one a day. And you can find that info. Cameron will so kindly link it for you in the show notes if you are not aware of where this exists.
Yes. If you wherever you find your podcast, there's a secondary RSS feed called Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate Daily Readalongs or something to that effect. It's our logo with a big Vasily Grossman face slapped on it. Hard to miss. That is where the complete repository.
To just Life and Fate chapter a day read along, because it sort of sounded like Vasily Grossman was reading along with us, the way that it was phrased. Which, you know, in spirit, he is.
He is. He's here probably, for us.
Probably. He doesn't seem like he would have been somebody to take kind to podcasters, so maybe not.
No.
Either that or he would have been a podcaster. It's hard to tell.
That's a great question. Maybe if we ever find a way to summon his ghost, we can ask him questions like, what do you feel about podcasting and where do you land on gonzo journalism? Yes.
The good listeners are going to have to support us pretty big time to see if we can get the equipment to start summoning ghosts now.
Yeah, we're going to need lots of equipment, probably a lot of sacrifices. I don't really know what's involved in that, but I feel like some kind of ritual. Anyway, we'll come back to that.
Money and or sacrifices, slaviclitpod.com.
Give us your least favorite sibling. Promise we won't return them. Anyway, you can find that wherever you get your podcast. It's got our complete repository. They are no longer being housed in our main feed after the month they're aired in, just so it doesn't get too confusing.
More like so you don't have to scroll past 300 episodes to find anything else.
Yeah, yeah, we figured that would be an impediment to anyone ever listening to anything else we ever put out again, so. Anywho.
But anyways.
Let's talk about this part itself. As we've done before, we won't be covering the individual events. You will go to our dailies if you would like to hear more about that. But just for a quick recap of what we are going to be covering in this episode, we kind of pick up on the very last chapter of Seryozha's storyline from the previous episode, which we're not going to cover, and then spend some time with Seryozha's father, Stepan, and his sister, Vera, who are still in the city of Stalingrad itself. Stepan is oversees the power plant there, and Vera is a nurse, although there are no longer any hospitals for her to really work at. So she's just kind of wandering about, everyone asking her why she's not evacuated, especially considering that she's pregnant now. And interesting attitudes to talk about for civilians on the front line like that. From there, we go to the Shaposhnikov sort of main family. Briefly, Victor having a very tense evening with some other friends of note, writers, scientists. They, after meeting with Karimov, they go and they have a discussion about the society they live in, which, of course, is always a great time when you live in the USSR. Very little disagreement, very little fear of who might be listening. Our good friend Dorensky is on the Kalmyk steppe and falls in love with some women he meets there. We return to the camps of the Mostovskoy, speaking with the old Menshevik Chernetsov, speaking with a colonel, less than reliable political element, Yershov, who would like to start a rebellion against the Germans before the good Bolsheviks come to Mostovskoy and tell him, no, we are doing our own thing and Yershov is not involved because, as we've mentioned, not a politically reliable element. And that ends with Mostovskoy being taken away by the SS, never what you want to happen to you. After that, Novikov, who is organizing his tank corps, is briefly summoned to Kuibyshev for, you know, the best kind of meeting, which is a meeting that didn't need to happen and isn't even completed because bigger things come up, which you really love when you've traveled presumably dozens to hundreds of miles or versts, whatever your preferred method of measuring distance is, to go to that meeting. And then he goes to have a great conversation with Yevgenia. And before we return to Victor, who has a brain blast, finally things are going his way. We join a German soldier, lieutenant, or I forget his exact rank, Bach, in the hospital, who is really getting into being a Nazi. He wasn't before. He's a character from Stalingrad, but now it's his time. Briefly go to Paulus, return to Dorensky. Finally, Mostovskoy, we return to him after he was taken away by the SS so many chapters ago, who spends much time in solitary confinement, expecting to be tortured, interrogated at any time, and find something much worse at the end of that path for him. A really friendly conversation with the commandant of the camp, the SS commander Liss, who actually sees them as brothers, whose embrace of Mostovskoy is so frightening that Mostovskoy even briefly doubts Lenin and begins to read Konnikov's writings, which are quite radical for any era, really, but especially this time, for closing out this section in House 6-1 and the story, sort of Seryozha, Katya, and Krimov.
Sure did.
Yeah.
Sure did do that.
That sure did happen. That's a, yeah, yeah. Well, so in terms of...
Go off, Grossman.
Go off. is there anything anywhere you would like to start in this whole mire, this whole muck of everything we've covered so far?
Yeah, as you were talking about it, I think it might make sense to perhaps just briefly start with the muck of it all.
Yeah, for sure.
On maybe the pacing of it, as we don't really get the chance to talk about that always very much on our short episodes. And I think that as we're approaching the sort of halfway point in the book, which... I mean, we really have a habit of not looking at page number, but only chapter number when we plan series. And somehow we really do it to ourselves where we're somehow only on part three, yet we're halfway through the book. So we've managed to give ourselves an exceptional amount of reading in a confined period of time. So good for us on that.
Yeah, it's awesome.
But if you're wondering why we're halfway through the book, but only on episode three, well, that's why. There is a sort of pick up in the pace, I would say, in this part of the book compared to the first couple hundred pages. I think the amount of characters that we are introduced to exponentially more. Not only, well, I guess not just introduced to, but we're reintroduced to ones that we know, that we're going further down their storylines, and then you think, great, I've got a handle on all of the characters, and Grossman says, okay, how about a few more? And you say, thank you, Vasily, because you're already too far in to stop, and you're invested in how everyone's going to do and fare, and what the ultimate resolution of their storyline might be. As we're getting to sort of the culmination, or, you know, what might feel like the culmination of the battle, I think that the time that we're actually spending in each day of the real time in the narrative is slowing down. And I think that Grossman is using that time to give you insights into each of the characters, not just day by day, but almost sometimes within the same day. And that's the sort of impression that it gives, at least to me, when reading this part, the chapters that we're covering in part three, which, you know, well, I guess this is part two of the book, or book two, rather. So it does have an actual delineation within the narrative itself, but it's starting to feel like we're not just in the nice to meet you section of some of the characters. We're really in parts of their storyline that are starting to feel really critical. And it gives the narrative such a good element of suspense when you really want to hear and see how Mostovskoy is going to fare in the camp when he's summoned. Or we don't know at that point that he's summoned by Lys. We just know he's been taken away. And you're actually not even sure if he's alive or not based on how it ends. And so you get this wonderful, maybe not wonderful, but this sort of tension that is just continuing to rise as we go through the book. And the way that Grossman is chopping these chapters up, I think, is really contributing to that. And that's why I think when people say, oh, I could never read that book, it's so long, that's just kind of a crazy thing to say, because some books are paced differently than others. This one, I do not think, feels quite like the slog of some other 800,000-page books might. Personally, I enjoy the slog, so maybe don't listen to me, but right. That's where I wanted to start.
Personally, I wish there was more slog. This is a little bit too exciting, but...
it's a little too interesting, I'll say that. Yeah. It could use some farming scenes, I think.
Right. That's true. I mean, there's so much taken from Life and Fate. Why wasn't there more about farming? You're right. I mean, I guess the science is maybe the rough.
Don't you want to steal make that my parallel. Point. Don't steal my point. Okay. Don't listen to my point from weeks ago and then repeat it back to me. How dare you?
It's in your notes right there.
Yeah, I know it. I already said it on an episode, so walk that back. Cut right. that out. All right, when I make the point later, it sounds really smart.
Yeah, okay, that's right. That's right. Sorry, I'll cut that out. I gotta right. do some USSR style editing here. but yeah, I think that's a great point, especially around the pressure. You'll see that in a lot of places. I mean, for me, the kind of peak of that is General Paulus's chapter, which I don't have a lot to say on that chapter other than, you know, the whole chapter is basically this war isn't fun anymore, sad face.
Yeah.
But you do get to see, I mean, this like the little details, and this isn't a deeper analysis, but I just love the detail of a general who once was so cavalier, so ready to go about the day, didn't even read the news, just knew the Red Army is going to do badly today, suddenly and slowly start quickly turning to the intelligence reports such that his subordinates start putting that to the top. Just such a in terms of characterization, especially if you've been following and ring the bell all the way from Stalingrad, from the triumphal beginning of that novel with Hitler, you know, smashing his fist down the table and thinking this is exactly how he's crushing Europe. Well, in this chapter now, it's no longer a fist, it's an open hand staking out, because there could be failure on any one of these fingers. But even then, doesn't seem to be quite enough. And also, most importantly, war isn't fun anymore. Sad face, single tear.
Well, it does really remind me of Anna Karenina in this sense, just because that opening line is so famous. All happy families are... oh, geez, now I'm going to blank on the opening line. Ah, that's it. That's it. I just want to double check. There we go. Yeah. I was going to make it way more wordy, because I have a habit of being unapologetically verbose for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
Much to the chagrin of all of my advisors. But so the opening line, happy families are all alike, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And that sort of is where Grossman starts his narrative, in the sense that we don't really need to see that much of how the Nazis are marching through the rest of the world. I mean, like, that's not the moment to give us the insight into how the generals are feeling, because you know that they're feeling good. What we get is we get that moment of unhappiness. We get when it switches. We get the change, and Grossman is really interested in sort of fleshing out those dynamics and seeing what it looks like when someone who is so certain about what they believe in and what they're doing, what does it look like when they finally meet some resistance and they finally have to put those beliefs sort of to the test with whatever it is that they are being met with. And it gives us a really great stage to watch this action unfold.
Hmm. Yeah.
And he does that with everybody.
Right.
Nobody is at a static moment in their life. Part of that is war makes that easy.
Hmm.
Because everything is hitting the fan. But my point stands.
Yeah, well said.
Thank you.
From there, do you mind if we kind of take it from the top? I was kind of thinking we could start with the dinner at Sokolov's, but we could also talk about loss. That's something that is all well throughout this part of the book.
Yes. Why don't we start with loss, maybe anxiety, perhaps?
Mm, okay.
Right before the dinner, I just wanted to very briefly touch on Vera, because she is such a symbol of hope throughout Stalingrad, and especially at the end of Stalingrad. And I just find it so interesting how much her character has shifted in the role that it's playing in Life and Fate, which I would say is largely non-existent. And the chapters that you get from her are, you know, what we had seen today or previously were sort of out of touch in a lot of ways, kind of just dreaming that Viktorov might come back, that every plane that passed was Viktorov up in the sky waiting to come down to her. And what we see in this part is the anxiety setting in that, oh no, like, I'm pregnant and I'm going to have this baby during the war, and all I've seen for months and months and months has been a gray sky full of airplanes with black swastikas and fire and an earth that is completely scorched and people dying all around. What kind of baby am I going to give birth to? And I think in Stalingrad there was this little bit of hope for the future and for the next generation. And I think the optimism, maybe you can say, is still there to some degree, but I think it's very much tempered by the fact that this is a generation that's going to be defined by this conflict and by an unimaginable effect that the war is going to have on them going forward. So it's, I would say, not quite as optimistic.
Right. Yeah. And to, I'll briefly repeat a point. We made this when we covered this chapter in the Daily episode 2, but all these characters who surround Vera, two important things to note here. I think one, you start to see the beginning of, or Grossman's portrayal of the beginning of this culture of valorization of everything regarding World War II. Well, everything that looks good regarding, you know, the Great Patriotic War, where everyone here, every worker is a hero. You know, Vera's father, Stepan, is in a meeting called a hero, and that makes him decidedly uncomfortable. And frankly, most people there, if they could, would flee if they had the energy or ability or reasonably thought they could actually make it. They probably wouldn't keep working there, and they're decidedly not heroes. And for Grossman, who's ever the champion of complex characters, doesn't count that as a mark against them, as if that's a failure. No, they're not really heroes. Actually, they're cowards. No, the very fact of this heroism and cowardice exists side by side. That's the human experience. And part of that experience, too, is living. Eventually, there will be labels put upon you. In this case, from the Soviet government, they need heroes. So they designate these people here who are tired, anxious, afraid, drinking too much, as their heroes to make them something bigger than they are. And that exists alongside the fact that that it's terrifying to occupy the position they do, and they would easily not if they could. And that's one thing. And, you know, this culture of heroism seen all throughout hero cities to today. I remember, I think Matt and I were in elementary school, maybe in middle school. And as soon as you walked into the lobby, there was like a big memorial to World War II and all the soldiers who'd maybe been to that school or were relatives of students there who died, and even like a model submachine gun in a glass case from that era in the lobby. I assume that was a model. Yeah, right. It's like, right, like, that's, you know, America has a pretty strong culture of worship of World War II, but I really feel like I can't.
Do you think so? I feel like we have a strong culture of, like, making World War II documentaries. I don't know if I'd say it's worshipful.
Maybe it's the particular family I grew up in, which was, like, a World War II dedicated family.
Right.
My family specifically, you know, my grandparents never, I mean, they didn't talk about it all the time, but, like, the fact that they were, my grandfather was, didn't fight in World War II. He was a tradesman, so he wasn't allowed to join, but he joined afterwards. But my grandmother was in AWACS, so on that side anyway. My grandparents at the other side were in the occupied Philippines. They had a much less good time, and they don't like talking about that period, or they didn't when they were alive. So my particular family, I feel like that was brought up a lot. I watched a lot of documentaries all the time. My mother would go over their service records. So that's in my family. Maybe that's not true for everyone, but from my perspective, which maybe had a family which had maybe talked about it more than most, that like what we experienced in Russia was pretty strong.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so there's that. The other thing I also wanted to emphasize too is Vera's in this really weird place. Like he said, in Stalingrad, she's the symbol of hope. And here there is very little, except for like that one brief little spark where there are still the workers who are very nice to Vera. And she begins to hope that maybe this child will grow up to be empathetic and kind, but that is a maybe. And as, you know, connecting that to, maybe you could connect that to Ikonnikov later on. The hope of this story is a very small, very measured, very reserved hope. Not a hope for a better future, although Grossman knows that they do survive this war, but I think this reflects later anxieties as well. The hope of a better future is not found in everyone gloriously marching forward, being a better person, all these things. The hope for the future is found in merely the fact that we might hold on to this human kindness, which might be the most important thing that we have. But it is a maybe.
Yeah. It's sort of, in this case, I think that it's a hope that there will be a future at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in his previous book, it was easier to say, okay, this person's pregnant, looking out over the Volga at the end of the novel, if I remember correctly. Here's some optimism. She's going to have a child. It's going to continue on. That's great. You can literally look and say, that person will continue on my legacy. Here, Grossman kind of says, it's much more abstract that, well, there is some sense of goodness that's innate to all of us that may continue to carry on, or that probably will continue to carry on. Almost certainly, but there's, you know, maybe a little bit of doubt. And I think the question in this book that's not raised in Stalingrad is it worth continuing to carry on? In the face of all this destruction, why carry on when we are capable of doing this? Why should we continue to live when we do this? And it's a good question, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's very few times in history probably that you can look at that, or you can look at the situation and kind of throw your hands up and say, why bother with anything at all?
Yeah.
And clearly seeing what he had seen firsthand and talked to the people that he had talked to firsthand, that would be something that would kind of shake anybody, I would think.
I would hope, at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I think now is a good time for a break. We'll be back in just a second.
This episode is brought to you by you, our listeners. You can support independent podcasting by heading to our website, slaviclitpod.com. You'll get access to the notes we use to make this episode, including links to all secondary sources mentioned.
If you want to support the show but don't want to spend any of your hard-earned doubloons, you can join our email list for free at slaviclitpod.com, or you can leave us a nice review wherever you get your podcasts.
Questions? Comments? Want to appear on our Office Hours podcasts? Drop us a line. You can reach our voicemail at 209-800-3944. Or you can also email us a voice recording or text question at slaviclitpod@gmail.com. We'll bring your question onto the podcast and do our best to address it.
All right, let's get back to the front. So we can go to a dinner party if you want.
Let's go to the dinner party.
Now, this is sort of our War and Peace type dinner party.
Right.
You think about it.
Okay, yeah, please elaborate on that. What do you mean? How do you mean that?
I don't mean it in any smart way whatsoever. Just in the fact that people are getting together. I think that if I am forced to elaborate on it, and I accidentally said that during grad school and now someone's boring in on me, what I would say is the first dinner party that we get in War and Peace, we are introduced to Pierre, who is so not really good at being at dinner parties. And it's not that he's not supposed to be there, but based on his manners, he probably shouldn't be. And there are a whole bunch of people who are getting together, diplomats, nobility, you know, they're kind of all belonging to the same group in society. And that's the main difference, I think, that we get between War and Peace and Sokolov's dinner party, is that these are people that are getting together that would not have been getting together otherwise. And so in exile, they're presented with this really interesting situation that we've talked about, where people actually have more freedom than they do normally. And so this is one of the great paradoxes, I think, that Victor is wrestling with throughout this dinner party and throughout the, well, it's simply a dinner party. They're like hanging out after work. So it's functionally kind of similar, but aesthetically not at all the same, right?
Right.
They're in exile, huddled together in somebody's apartment after work, after they've been working all day at a scientific laboratory. Well, some of them are, you know, not scientists. So that is what Victor is trying to wrestle with, is why is it that in the most severe moments of repression, being pushed back to the end of the world, as it's sometimes framed, when what they mean by that is just not in Moscow, which is a really hilarious way to phrase that. I think that it's such a like Moscow-centric way to think of your enormous state, that when you're not in Moscow, you're basically not anywhere. And
what could be out this far in the steppe? An empire, right, that once controlled the world? Pshaw.
And if you look at the map, I don't want to even go into this, but the Call Me Steppe chapters, like, it's not that far from from the city center, but like there are way further areas than that, but I digress. I lost my train of thought, but that just, it cracked me up so much.
Yeah.
That is the sort of thing that Victor is wrestling with, is why is it that this is when we are most free to talk like this, and this is when I have a sense of freedom with my research that previously didn't exist, when he was probably given, I mean, almost any resource imaginable to do his work. It's very important scientific work for the state, so there probably weren't a lot of roadblocks for him previously. Now there are, because they're in exile, they're fighting a war, they don't have money, they don't have logistics to get things to him. So why is it now, huddled up in his friend's living room, you know, spending too much attention, paying too much attention to his wife, that this is when he feels the most free?
Hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Why is it, Cameron? I'd love to know.
I'd love to know too. I mean, I think it's interesting. This chapter particularly, I would say, really makes me, when I think back on the fact that he tried to get this published in the Soviet Union, astounds me more than anything, that of the faith, like Vasily Grossman. I don't know if he had much in the Soviet Union at that point, but he had enough to write lines like, what is this? Hold on. No one talked like this before the war. This is how as they're all getting into sort of questioning 1937, not quite openly, but definitely not talking about some people who've been liquidated in the ways they're supposed to. No one had talked like this before the war. The might of the state had constructed a new past. It had made the Red Cavalry charge a second time. It had dismissed the genuine heroes of long past events and appointed new ones. The state had the power to replay events, to transform figures of granite and bronze, to alter speeches long since delivered, change the faces in a news photograph. A new history had been written. Even people who had lived through those years now had to relive them, transformed from brave men to cowards, from revolutionaries to foreign agents.
You think that shouldn't get published?
I think it's astounding that he was writing lines. This is not the only line in the book which is like that, but it's lines like that which make me astounded that he's like, yeah, I'm going to go give this to the press. They will almost certainly publish this in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he felt that after the war, there would be a sort of breaking of the dam, so to speak, because you have defeated the great fascist enemy. So what is there left to fear? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think that's an optimistic historical counterfactual. I don't know if that's really what he thought. Probably not.
Yeah, for sure. But it's one of those things that I think now when you read that, I can't speak to people outside the US, but I'm sure almost every American student has had to read 1984, and you read that and you're like, well, yeah, of course, naturally, not taking into account the time and place that Grossman is writing this particular sort of line in, right? My issues with 1984 aside, and believe me, I have a lot, and I'll link.
Don't get them going.
Of another 40-minute episode on how I feel about that. But anyway, yeah. Just a notable thing to mention, and like you say about the freedom, really reemphasizing this conversation, not just this feeling of freedom that they all have, but literally having conversations that they would never have brought up in Moscow. We have,
And you know what I love about those conversations?
Yes.
Is that the most incendiary topics that they talk about have to do with literature and the arts. I love that. I think that we have so lost that importance. I think that it's not necessarily like, it's definitely not deliberate in all senses, although there is a case to be made on that I won't go into. But I just do love reading about times where that was what was really highly valued and really hotly contested. And it's something that I think is really hard to picture now, because we have never lived in a time where art has mattered. At least I can speak for myself. I have not.
Yeah.
Maybe if you're older, you could say maybe there was, but it just doesn't really seem to be the case. Certainly not in this way. I mean, somebody going to jail for their art, unless maybe they're like, their art is also overlapping with vandalism, then probably not. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I can think of examples, but the only place I could think of art in American life is when some reactionary grabs an artist who they don't like and just makes them some kind of like cause celebrate to fight against. Like, they'll, in some way, this artist will have worked at some institution which receives government funding, and then that becomes a larger political campaign. There's a particular artist, I can't remember his name. He was the one who did Piss Christ, who there's like a politician who made him that. But like, that's, I mean, that's, you know, a few weird cases. That's not an everyday people having that kind of conversation. You're right.
Yeah. And I don't really have a larger point to make other than it's scary, though, to think conversely about the fact that a conversation like that could send you to jail.
Yeah.
We could be, honestly, it makes you think that podcasting in that sense could be perhaps the most dangerous job.
If you really think about it, we really are quite brave for putting this out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And we should be celebrated for it.
Number one podcasters, after that's like military, firefighter. Oh, don't forget teacher.
Teacher, yeah. Well, that's teacher. A pretty distant second, but suppose that deserves the list. Let's move on from this before we actually end our podcast. But I do think at the very end of this chapter, there's a kind of I forget who's it that makes this point. I think it's it's Victor. Victor, well, you know, as we talked about in the Daily, Victor all throughout this chapter has no real point to stand on. He just kind of argues against whoever spoke last. But I do think he does make an interesting point, which is we talk so much about compare against Ikonikov's point of view, right? Later in the novel, which is that he only believes in human kindness, and that's the most important thing. And Victor, I think there's something, Victor's not meant to be taken on face value, these points here, but I do think he kind of makes it a fair point, which is, you know, how can you say that we don't need, you know, the USSR? If it weren't for the USSR, we wouldn't have the industry to build the weapons we have to fight back the fascist invaders. And I think that's kind of been a little bit, you're not supposed to take everything he says seriously, but I don't think that's an unfair point, that you say whatever you will about the state in terms of fighting other states like the Wehrmacht, that does require a fair amount of technical industry in production, which is, I think, maybe not the overall point of this book, but I think it's unintentionally a fair rebuttal. Although that gets into, I think there's this, when ancient poli-sci was told this thing called the parable of the tribes, about how in fighting a power maximizer state, you become more like them, and as a way to explain how state relations come about. I think that might be more of a personal point than something this book is trying to make, but I found it interesting.
I kind of don't know exactly what to make of Victor over these few chapters, because there are some things that he says that I'm like, that's not a good point.
Right.
But I think that part of that, sort of desire he has to just engage in debate for its own sake. It almost feels like he's just starved for this type of environment where he can evaluate different points on their own. And that's something that is completely lacking. He has no point throughout this book does he have the ability to actually evaluate his own ideas sort of on their own. He's only working within the pre-approved ideological dogma. That's what so much of his science chapters are about, is trying to patch up any new discovery that he finds and say, okay, now I have to make this part of the main theory, otherwise it can't work. And so I think it's maybe refreshing for him to have a situation where he's able to just talk and argue, and maybe it doesn't make any sense. Maybe he doesn't really believe in what he's arguing, but that is a luxury that has previously not been afforded to him or to anybody, when you could go to jail for having a contradictory opinion, right? And, you know, counterpoint, maybe you don't have to say it out loud to evaluate it, but there is something to be said about the sort of verbal conversation and debate.
Yeah, right. And to your point, if you don't mind us continuing, just kind of skipping the chronology of the book, but continuing forward to part two, when Victor leaves that and suddenly the apartment, and suddenly has a great moment of inspiration, which leads him to having a breakthrough in his work. To your point about him being able to evaluate that out loud, it's that very process of, okay, does this actually, does my tool hold up when I use it against Rock? He is suddenly able to reformat his mind around fixing the problem. And the rough explanation we're given, which I won't say I completely follow the logic, but I also, I don't think we are meant to, is the fact that he's able to pull this idea together because he stops thinking about all these elements as discrete things and starts thinking about the relationship between all of these different fields in his head. And not only the relationship between different fields, but the relationship between the fields and non-scientific fields, between his work and his life. And he's beginning to pull together novel connections, which are not prescribed to him, right? He's not trying to make the action, the experiments he's doing, fit the results he's supposed to get. He says, okay, well, if we're looking for a certain outcome, then maybe we need to alter our inputs instead. Maybe that's what we need to start looking at. And that's, I think, what is how we are to understand his breakthrough, is this sort of novel thinking, which is difficult when typically your expectation is, okay, here's the theory, here's the outcome, now make it work, is not typically the way you go about science at this particular point in the Soviet Union. That's not how it will always be in the Soviet Union. That's not how it always was. But in this period, for a while, it gets a little weird.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I think that what Grossman is showing, if I may argue this, is the overlap really between science and art. In the sense that, at least maybe traditionally conceived, or, I won't get into that much of a debate on art because we can go forever. I will just say, in general, we often think of art as something that comes to us through some sort of jolt of inspiration, or, you know, the sense of freedom of our mind allows us to come up with organically these different ideas. And that's how he comes to his theory. It's this organic inspiration. Maybe it's a little bit of a, you know, capital R romantic idea of how art in science works, but it is how Victor is kind of thinking, that it's not when he's sitting there running his experiments that he deduces this or comes up with this. He does this through some sort of synthesis of everything that has emerged in that conversation and everything that he has in his brain up until that point. And so that's why I kind of thought that these chapters function in a very similar manner to Levin's farming chapters, because that is sort of what they do in that novel as well, in Anna Karenina, where all of these chapters where Levin spends time implementing agricultural reforms and working with the peasants and all, so much wheat, everybody that I talk to frequently does not like those chapters. At least a lot of students don't like those chapters. I can understand why. It's not the same as not quite the same as the rest of the book, maybe, but they have a really important function in the overall narrative and the overall point of what is going on in the book. I do actually think that Grossman does a much better job of making that explicit and really tying all of it together. Actually, I think it's better. He does it better than Tolstoy. Part of it, I think, is that there's less of it, so it's not quite as in your face. And I don't know. It was something that was really sticking out to me on this read.
Yeah, definitely. And I think reading this particular chapter, there's one line that made me think back on some of the works we've covered on the earlier Soviet Union, thinking back on Cement, Envy, even point towards some of the novels we have not covered, right? A lot of elements of these earlier novels are about kind of conquering the elements in one way or another, conquering the social situation you're in, conquering the sort of chaos around the factory, right? Whatever, like conquering the chaos of us not being able to follow through to the plan, whatever it may be. In this one, instead of man overcoming chaos, rather it is the chaos which allows man to continue on. And there's this line, it's the thing that kind of held them back was the unsuccessful experiments, but that is why he kept trying to do these things, and that's how they've come to this point. And Victor thinks, and yet if it hadn't been for those unsuccessful experiments, if it hadn't been for the resulting chaos, he and Sokolov would have gone on trying to patch up the old theory. What a joy that chaos had refused. What a joy that chaos had refused to yield to their demands. So, as opposed to, you've got to conquer chaos, now it's a more... I hesitate to call it like almost a Taoist perspective of accepting and working with the world, but it kind of is.
Yeah, it is also in some ways similar to the agricultural reform section in Anna Karenina, where you can't just slap on something that works somewhere else without consideration for the conditions of where you are doing that. Mm. It's they both have this similar strain running through them.
Right. Yeah. Here, Grossman talks about chaos. There, Tolstoy talks about English farming. But then I repeat myself in terminology. I feel like that's the main thing I took away from that section. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to cover for kind of his, I don't know, enlightenment, whatever we want to call it. I mean, there's there is when they start moving back to Moscow, the minor point where Victor's still so deep into it, he's really ignoring his family. And when Anna Naumovna is like, hey, it's kind of weird how like every Jewish person we know who's not a scientist is like being left off the list to go back to Moscow, right? And Victor's like, nope, I don't see a problem with that at all. He's remembering his Jewishness, but is accusing other people who see possible issues around anti-Semitism of, quote, shtetl inferiority complexes. So, yeah, he's...
Yeah, so here's the thing. I really don't think Victor's that good of a person.
Yeah, right. No.
I'm not sure. Hard to say.
I've said it before. Victor's not a one-to-one author avatar, but he really is the, if anyone in this book can be called one, he is. And I kind of respect that Grossman made his author avatar just such a dickhead.
Yeah, I think Tolstoy wrote Levin thinking like, wow, look at that. Isn't he pretty cool? Isn't he kind of a good guy we should all root for? Right. And we read it and we're like, I don't know. I don't know if it's one-to-one, but he's definitely a character who was not written without faults.
Yeah.
The way that he is so engulfed in his work that he really can't give any emotional energy whatsoever to his wife, who is still grieving, nor his daughter, who clearly could use some role model, even though she sees Victor as her role model and emulates his behavior often. It drives him crazy when he sees his own behavior in his children, and he still is unable to reflect on why that is, because, or maybe just he uses it as an excuse, his work.
Mm-hmm.
So
right,
maybe Grossman was like that, I don't know.
given what we know of his life, I would not disbelieve that.
Yeah,
but do you mind, maybe this is a good spot to talk about the Wolfhound Century and those, I guess, causing it, really. Do you want to talk about fascism?
If we must.
Well, I think in this case we must, because this is fascism. What fascism is such an integral part of Stalingrad. It's trying to, it's almost a didactic text in that regard. Here is what fascism is, right? Here is the review of the Soviet army, here is what it looks like in the Wehrmacht. Constant surveillance, constant suspicion. Is that guy over there an SS informant? What is the case? When we go back to the back lines, everyone's unhappy and alienated. And for the most part, their perspective has been absent in the novel up to this point, when we get a lot of it in a relatively short period of time, first in Bach, Peter Bach, and then secondarily in the Commandant Liss. And it's kind of it's fascinating. The through line is still there. There's no change in how I think Grossman portrays fascism, but how he's portraying the people, its adherence, I think, is really interesting, because you have the fanatics, and I don't know if Grossman doesn't really address them, maybe because they're not worth speaking about. What do you say about a fanatic? Okay, they believe it. Much more interesting, maybe, is Bach, who is, as we've said before, this interesting example of someone who always saw himself on the outside of the party, of the Nazi party. He's not a member. He has Jewish friends. His parents are Marxists. He does not have the same sort of racial animus that guides so many others. He's sort of I'm just a believer in the importance of Germany and the belief in a German soul and a German character. And, well, of course I have Jewish friends, but if a German soul and a German character exists, then so too it must be the case that a Jewish soul and a Jewish character exists. But, you know, I'm sort of an egalitarian myself. I wouldn't kill Jews en masse if it were up to me. If it were necessary, sure. But that's if I was in charge. I'm not in charge. I just follow orders, right? And so he's given all these chances to, all these reasons in his life to object to fascism as it exists. But because of this sort of, I think Grossman is sort of tying it to an underlying nationalism. You've made this point before of the individuals become subsumed by culture, right? Where he says, like, well, it's bad that we hate Jews because Einstein was sort of a German. It's a little contradictory, but I mean, it's fascist ideology, sure. He could, if he had stayed in our society, he could have contributed so much. It's not about the individual, it's what you contribute to, in this case, this culture, the German culture. And you see in this sort of nationalism the ultimate sublimation of the individual to the culture itself. You are not your own. You are not your own person. You are only your contributions to society. I think you can see how that flows pretty naturally into fascist beliefs, where the individual is nothing. The Volk is everything. I think he's tying those senses together, and that's this tying, not just in not portraying fascism as this weird other thing, this strange outcropping, but rather as a natural outcome of nationalism. I think is a really interesting point actually to make, because even to today, I think there's this idea of Nazism as sort of this special, unique thing, when I think Grossman, his portrayal here is much more nuanced, and fascism, Nazism is not this strange, weird outgrowth of this particular place and time. Maybe Nazism itself is, but the beliefs and attitudes of Nazism are inherently entrenched in this sort of particular ethno-nationalist approach to things. And this is not a unique point that Grossman makes. There's another author and many, many others besides. I'm thinking most specifically of Aimé Césaré, who is a, I want to say French-Algerian writer. I'll correct that later if that's not correct. But he writes an essay in which he says that he argues World War II is essentially inevitable, because the ways in which the attitudes, the nationalism, the attitude of extraction and the need for national growth in this ethno-nationalist empire in Europe of the colonial era, which was initially inflicted on Africa. Well, of course, that circle was going to close on where can we actually extract resources? I guess we might need to come closer to home. So who at home is not really like us? And it's unsurprising that Hitler emerges out of this, because Hitler is just applying the same thing that Europe did to Africa and Asia and South America, North America, and applying it to itself instead. So this is a natural outgrowing of European colonial attitudes This is not the exact same argument that Grossman is making, but I think it is a parallel one. I think it actually still is a relevant one, because seeing fascism not as a strange, otherly thing, but something that grows out of our own attitudes and things that exist in all of our societies is an important and provocative point. And Liss, I think, Liss stands in a different place than Bach does, but Liss, I think, does have many of the same attitudes taken to a stronger example, and you can see where that starts to become relevant, not only for German society, but for example, the Soviet Union, when Liss is speaking with Mostovskoy and pulls him in and says, look, we're basically, you know, brothers. You know as well as we do that nationalism is the most powerful force of our century. Nationalism, he says to Mostovskoy, is the soul of our epoch. And socialism in one country is the supreme expression of nationalism. And socialism of one country is the policy of the USSR at this time, the earlier internationalists who, you know, Trotskyists who wanted to spread that all over the world are now considered wreckers. And it's important to just have socialism in the USSR, and that's the most important thing over spreading revolution to the world. So he identifies these parallels between their two societies and says we are much the same in that regard. And when we talk about what is the use in comparing the USSR to Nazi Germany, what is there better use than to just say, well, this thing's bad, and I'm comparing it to this other thing, and it's also bad. I think this is an important one because you start to see how the same underlying features of different societies, completely different political situations, then start to bring them towards a similar point. And I think that's why this is a really interesting understanding of fascism that Grossman is developing here.
Yeah, and you brought up that good point earlier about why not talk about the believers? Mm. Because we kind of already know what it means to be a believer in something. And I think what's funny is that I think that Grossman psychologizes the believers on the Soviet side much more than on the Nazi side. I think that that is the, for him and for the society as a whole, that is the one of the tragedies, is that all of the real believers in their system, they've rounded up, killed, and put in camps. And so what they're left with are basically political operators that in some ways do operate very much the same as the operators on the Nazi side, right? And so there is some element of truth to what Liss is saying. And it is very controversial, I think. I think this, maybe even more so, is an amazing thing to think that it could have been published in the Soviet Union.
Right. Yeah.
This was one of the chapters where I was like, yeah, no way.
Right. Yeah. Well, it kind of makes me think of, as you say that, it makes me think of Cement, where I, for the life of me, I cannot remember his name, but in this, this is one of the reasons why I think we both agree that Cement is a really interesting novel, despite what everyone will say about it, is that you have some of the strongest believers in communism be expelled from the party in favor of I forget the term that's not bureaucrats. It's like, what's the term that's not apparatchik? Bureaucrats from the monarchist government who understand the system, know how to work people, know how to work organizations. And they're not really true believers or believers in any sense, but they know how to make things work. So it's important to have them around. In fact, more important to have them around than these know-nothing do-gooders, these know-nothing do-gooder communists who we have to expel from the party. And now we're seeing seeing that same society 40, 50 years onward. I mean, Cement's like, I hope we're doing a lot of bad things, and I hope our children can forgive us and live in a great society. And now their children are living in that society, and that is a real question. Can we forgive them for what they did? And as Mostovskoy briefly thinks for a moment, is no. In fact, it is their actions. It is not Stalin taking us in the wrong direction. It was that Lenin misled us from the start. Very briefly, he thinks that. But
yeah, it's a tough end, I think, to the section that we've chopped off here to figure out what it all means and where we all stand in relationship to it.
Yeah. Well,
I think we go through a similar whiplash, probably is the best way to describe it, much like Mostovskoy, through the camp, the interrogation, and then reading Ikonnikov's letter, which is a sort of, well, how would you describe it? I would describe it as this sort of Tolstoyan type essay.
I describe it as like an expression of Tolstoyan anarchism.
Yeah. Yeah. Where he's talking about how the only thing that is truly retained, that core element of humanity, are these small kind of, what would you say, not unimaginable, but inexplainable things that we do, these small acts of goodness or small acts of kindness, which is such a Tolstoyan, Gary Saul Morrison formulation of it. And that is what I think he is saying, is that that is what is retained, that is what makes us human, that is the good that can never be crushed in not just the battle against evil, but evil's battle against good, which it will not and cannot ever win.
Yeah, right.
It's very powerful. I don't know that it is a real actionable sort of plan. I don't know that it really makes anyone feel any better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. When we talk about this, as we go into much greater detail in our daily episode, but it really is a provocative moral stance to take, because when Mostovskoy is reading this with contempt, you might, because of the way we're being set up, think, yeah, no, Konnikov is right. But like, really, take Mostovskoy seriously for a second. You're in a like Nazi prison camp. If you are like, who is going to fight the Nazis if you don't have states who stand up to them, who are building the sort of industry? And I know we conceive of the Soviet Union as doing industry kind of uniquely badly. And frankly, there's a lot of, I think it's fascinating how the Soviets set up their industry. It did very well in some ways, did very badly in other ways. But anyway, Soviet industrialization was horrible and awful. That being said, so industrialization everywhere was horrible and awful, and it tended to be offloaded usually onto immigrants. And so that's why I think we in societies tend to overlook the massive costs of industrialization, of building the railroads, because the thousands, tens of thousands, the unnumbered dead of these things in all our other countries were mostly not our own people, so to speak. Of course, depending on who you are, it might have been theoretically your people, but like, I mean that in a sense of like, the people building it didn't see those who did the action of doing it as their own, so they aren't tended to be counted. Historians obviously go back and try to do so now, but what I'm saying by that is, yeah, Mostovskoy's stance is like, implies a lot of violence and horror, but so does Konnikov's, in a society in which someone else does do what Nazi Germany has, and then no one else is there to fight back. It has industrialized to that capacity. And despite all that, I also can't say that Konnikov is wrong. And I don't know if these are necessarily contradictory points. They're just provocative ones to exist alongside each other in the time that they do. And I don't have an answer. I just think this is a fascinating thing to consider and take both sides really seriously on this argument.
I think that it is a good point that you just made, that they can both coexist. That, different points can coexist.
Yeah.
Because that is what so much of all of these sides are fighting for, is for their thing, their idea, their ideology to be the exclusive and only one that can ever exist. And I think that this is one way that Grossman kind of does illustrate that there can be differing points of view. There may be, something that is higher than ideology. And so the point might not be to be actionable. It is, Konnikov is making a spiritual point, basically. It is above law. It has nothing to do with practicality, but it does sort of make you question, right? And in that situation, I mean, I don't know about you, but I would want to know, what am I supposed to do? And I think that, I don't know, maybe in the situation ideology doesn't help and there is no way to know what to do 100%, and so you need these higher truths to believe in the fact that the goodness of humanity will not be eradicated no matter what. But yeah, no, I think it's still a tough pill to swallow, as this is what you're looking at.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's all I had to say in that section. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to cover.
We can probably wrap up.
I think so. I before we go, I just want to mention, hey, Seryosha and Katya have a nice point. I don't, it's one not not the worst ending we've had. Seryozha and Katya theoretically have brief nice time together, and Kryumov gets shot in the head. It's not the worst way we've ended one of these.
Grazed.
Well, if I was grazed in the head, I would tell everyone for sure I got shot in the head, because that's technically still true.
Right, but you're not an old bull.
That's right. Grazed, maybe by the Germans, maybe by Grekov. Who's to say?
really hard to say. Yeah, I think the Seryozha one is... I don't know. It was fine.
Dead cat counter goes up on it.
I don't have anything particularly profound on that ending, to be honest.
No, I don't. I think this everything that's happening here is setting up for things that to come. I agree. I don't think there's anything to analyze. I mean, I do think there's a brief moment in the kind of, we'll talk about this in the daily, but I think there's an interesting point when Katya talks about senior soldiers extracting sexual favors from women in order to keep them in certain positions. And I think that's one of many things that Grossman kind of briefly addresses, like a one-off line, which implies so much more story there, which I probably is a reflection of the massive amount of time he spent with the Red Army, and things that are really important stories to tell, but are just not the purview of this story. Just one of those things that I think is an important reflection of how much of a history there is there, history which may or may not have been written, and even if it was written, may or may not have been published, and in fact was probably not, because of the you can imagine why the USSR is like, well, maybe we just kind of quiet down, you know, a culture of forcing women to have, of commanders forcing women to have sex with them for, you know, X, Y, and Z. That doesn't look so good, so that's not getting published. And there are authors today who address that, but one story that has likely has been told many times privately, but I can't imagine has been published all that often.
That's nice. You think it's in a deliberate attempt to quiet it down. I take it as more of a, this was so commonplace that it doesn't even rise to the level of, it doesn't even appear significant to commanders or people that were in the military at that time. It was just so commonplace. And that's what I think is so interesting about that. It doesn't even, not that it doesn't deserve a story because it's not interesting, but because it's so commonplace that everyone already knows that story. And that's what I thought was so interesting about it. And you're right. That was the main point that I thought was interesting in that storyline. The Katya Seryozha, whatever. I mean,
yeah,
them together, sure.
Right, that happens.
Have fun. Have fun.
Yeah.
Have fun. Kids.
But other than that, I think you're right. This is probably a good place to close out for now.
I agree.
Okay, Matt. Well, you know, tough conversation. But before we totally wrap up, I gotta ask, what are we tackling next time?
Next time, be sure to bring your notes from class. We are going back to office hours. We haven't decided exactly what we're going to be tackling on it, but if we're doing what I think we're doing, it's going to be quite an entertaining one.
it'll be one to talk about.
We've got something that you are not going to want to pick up a copy of through our affiliate links on our website.
One of those rare books that we absolutely don't recommend.
No, and it made me want to stop reading altogether.
Honestly, yeah, a little bit. Maybe be embarrassed to be a reader. Yeah. Maybe be embarrassed to be literate, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. Illiteracy was a better solution. To help keep our show independent and for exclusive access to notes containing all the research that went into this episode, head on over to our website, SlavicLitPod.com. Before we let you go, we want to extend a sincere thank you to all of our current supporters.
Yes. And that's Emma, Lauren, Erica, Michelle, Juliana, Diane, Oleg, John, Timex, Melissa, Baron, Aldo, Ben, Gabe, George, Claire, Amy, Allie, Soraya, Jackson, Molly, Emma, Mike, Marianne, Mickey, Eric, Reagan, Mike, Peter, Eric, Ben, Claire, Jeff, Inez, Mai, Robert, Joseph, Daniel, Lou, Nina, Gary, Janice, Mary, Anne, Isaac, Emily, Amanda, Caitlin, Yitza, Irini, and Pack Rob. All one breath and still some breath left. Bad phrasing there, but whatever. Getting pretty good at this. The music used in this episode was Staraya Kino by Perumotka. You can find more of their stuff on Bandcamp or Spotify. The links and spelling are in the show notes.
You'll hear from us again soon.